Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Happy New Year, and welcome to this January 2010 installment of Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening, Jim Campanella. Before I get started with the science news for the evening, I just wanted to thank all my listeners out there for voting for this feature for the Sophie Awards. I appreciate your kind acknowledgement of the work I put into this craziness each month, and I can tell you that it can get to be a grind sometimes finding the time to get this done every month between family and work and my own Uvula audio bookcasts and anything additional that Tony ropes me into. It's good to know that you're appreciated, and I dedicate my 2009 Sophie Award to all you listeners who voted for me. I better stop this before I get all teary-eyed and start shouting about how much you like me. On to the first story of the night. And this story was pointed out to me by listener Pradeep Sanders, who thought it might make an interesting topic for discussion. Thank you, Pradeep. I missed the story entirely, even though it is a very important one, I think. The story concerns Tasmanian devils. Now, what I know about Tasmanian devils, I know from three places. One, Warner Brothers cartoons, as Bugs Bunny's nemesis. Two, my kids' Wiggles songs, as an animal that is just short of worship down under. And three, from a vague science story that one of my brothers-in-law mentioned several months back after hearing the previously mentioned Wiggles song. He told me that he had read, and he couldn't remember where, that Tasmanian devils were going extinct due to some sort of horrible disease. Now, that sounded kind of interesting, but seemed fuzzy enough information to not bother to follow up on, so I didn't. Well, months later, Pradeep emailed me with a New York Times link which contains actual details on the story, which is apparently true. It appears that, without medical intervention of some kind, the wild Tasmanian devils will probably be gone by 2035, and that's not all that long. So what is this story, then? Well, Tasmanian devils are marsupials found on the Australian island of Tasmania. The populations there have been decimated for the last few years by a weird, contagious form of cancer that seems to be killing them off. About 70% of the Tasmanian devil population has disappeared as a result of this disease. The cancer is called devil facial tumor disease. And the mystery of its origins and how it works, its horrid path of destruction, have been left unanswered so far. Well, in the January 1st issue of the journal Science, an answer has finally begun to be turned up. The research was performed by Dr. Elizabeth Murchison, who did the work in Dr. Gregory Hannon's lab at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York. Murchison and her team analyzed patterns of gene and microRNA activity in facial tumors and in healthy tissues. Now, microRNAs are small genetic molecules that help to regulate the activity of genes by helping determine whether messenger RNAs are translated into proteins or not. Messenger RNAs, if you don't remember, are those small snippets, or relatively large sometimes, of sequence that actually are passed from the DNA to the ribosome and tell the ribosome what protein to make. All of the 25 tumors that the team analyzed were genetically identical, indicating that they came from a single source, most likely a Tasmanian devil that lived about 20 years ago. That means that the cancerous disease arose from a single cell. Now, cancers are clonal in origin, meaning that all cancers start from one cell kind of going nuts and deciding that it'll keep growing out of control. Well, that means that this one devil, which lived about 20 years ago, had this one single mutant cell, and that it has been the source of all the cancers since. When they analyzed the microRNA signatures of both the tumors and healthy devil tissues, they found that the tumor cells most closely matched Schwann cells. Now, Schwann cells are a type of cell that forms a waxy sheath around nerve fibers, and that's called myelin. These cells and this myelin sheath are what are actually attacked in humans in multiple sclerosis. The myelin sheath is very important for ensuring that signals pass along very quickly down nerve fibers. Now, how these cancerous Schwann cells became contagious is still a mystery, though the researchers indicate that the devils are known to be prone to cancers, but they suggest that it was just, quote, some sort of freak of nature that allowed this cancer to be stable and transmitted, unquote. Apparently, The devils attack each other and wound each other regularly in the face, so they pass along the disease in this fashion. The weird mutated Schwann cells apparently are very good at avoiding the immune system, so they're passed along and then they grow into tumors. Some of the researchers quoted in the New York Times article call this a new type of parasite that's passed along through facial wounds. Now, calling this a new parasite or a form of life, I just find a bit bizarre and more than a bit titillating and not particularly scientific. I guess I'm not very surprised coming from the New York Times. I have to admit, though, that all of this is very strange. It is very hard to pass along cancer from one organism to another under normal circumstances. In my genetics classes, I describe how you can actually do this. But it can't really be done outside of a lab. And that's why cancer cannot normally go from one animal to another to another. First of all, you isolate DNA from a tumor in animal A. Then, you place that DNA into cultured cells grown in a petri dish from animal B. Then, you look closely for some of the cultured cells to actually become tumor cells. Then you isolate these transformed cells and inject them into animal B, where they came from originally. Now, animal B will then grow a tumor because his immune system will not be quick to attack cells from this B-type animal. This process will not work if you just inject animal B with tumor cells from animal A. The immune system will destroy them quickly under those conditions. And that is what makes the devil's cancer so bizarre. It breaks a rule that geneticists thought was pretty hard and fast. At any rate, now that they know the cause of the disease, it's thought that it shouldn't be too hard to make a vaccine against it and start a major vaccination program for wild devils. Well, when I say not too hard, I really mean relatively not hard. It sounds like a massive project to me. The next article absolutely blew my mind when I came across it in one of my favorite journals, the Journal of Experimental Biology, and it's from this month's issue. Seriously, this is an amazing story that will change the way you, see the world. According to doctors Divya Yeramilli and Sonke Jonsson from Duke University, sea urchins actually have vision and can see. This is not so amazing a story until you realize that sea urchins don't have eyes. For years, researchers have noticed that sea urchins don't seem to have any problems avoiding predators or finding comfortable dark corners to hide in, but they appear to do all this without any eyes. So how do they detect light? How do they see? Well, according to this new report, it appears that sea urchins may use the whole surface of their bodies as compound eyes, and the animal's spines may shield their bodies from light coming from wide angles to enable them to pick out relatively fine visual detail. Well, that was the hypothesis that Yeramilli and Jonsson had. If true, then it would follow that sea urchins with densely packed spines have better vision than sea urchins with sparsely packed spines. So they decided to test the vision of the purple sea urchin, Strongi locentrotus purpuratus. Now, the purple sea urchin has tightly packed spines, so they wanted to see how well they could see. The researchers placed individual sea urchins into a brightly lit area with a 6 or a 9 centimeter diameter dark disc on the wall. They then recorded 39 urchin responses to the disc at different positions around the area's perimeter. The researchers saw that the urchins wandered randomly around the area when the 6 centimeter diameter disc was in place. They didn't respond to it. However, it was different with the 9 centimeter disc. The urchins either raced toward it or fled in the opposite direction. Presumably, these urchins thought that the large disc was either shelter to hide in or an intruder of some kind, and they responded appropriately according to their own interpretation. Calculating the visual angle of the 9 centimeter diameter disc from a sea urchin's perspective, Yeramilli and Jonsson suggest that the sea urchin's visual resolution is at least 10 degrees. When the pair calculated the sea urchin's visual resolution based on the animal's spine density, they found that it could be as good as 8 degrees, which isn't, by the way, good enough to see a small 6 centimeter diameter disc, which is why they didn't respond to the smaller disc. Now, what's most surprising in this whole study is that the urchin's vision is as good as the sea nautilus and the horseshoe crab, which both have eyes. Now, that's pretty darn extraordinary for an animal that has turned its whole body into an eye. Okay, so let's go from some sea buggers to a slightly higher form of life. Humans. Now, on the first day of class when I teach genetics, I try to drum into the heads of my students that you can have two organisms which have exactly the same DNA, twins, and yet they may come out very different physically. One of the prime reasons for this is the environment that we all live in. Our environment affects how our genes are expressed, and even more so, which genes are expressed and when. Unless two genetically identical organisms are brought up in exactly the same environment, they will turn out differently. Hence, The Boys from Brazil, the book and movie about cloning Hitler, are pure tosh. If you did clone Hitler, those clones would never grow up into the crazed and hateful dictator who we all know and despise. That is because it is so difficult to reproduce all the environmental conditions that made the original nutter. Well, it turns out that there are immune system diseases that respond to alterations in the environment, leaving two identical twins in a situation where one may have the disease and the other one not at all. First of all, let me point out something that you may not know. It's possible to have the genetic sequence be exactly the same in two people, but have chemical alterations of those same sequences, which are not the same. The classic example of this is something called methylation. Methylation is the addition of a chemical group called a methyl to DNA sequences. Methyl groups have the same structure more or less as methane gas. At any rate, one way that cells have of turning off genes is to add methyl groups in front of them in the DNA sequence. Presumably, this keeps the enzymes that read the DNA from being able to do that very efficiently, and the genes in that area are essentially shut down. In the December issue of the journal Genome Research, Dr. Esteban Ballestar of the Bellvitge Biomedical Research Institute in Barcelona found that the inflammatory disease lupus responds to DNA methylation. If one twin has less DNA methylation, that leaves that twin vulnerable to the inflammatory autoimmune disease, even while the other sibling remains healthy, who has a lot more methylation. In other words, the twin with more methylation has more potentially dangerous disease genes shut down that would otherwise be active in causing the disease. This finding suggests that environmental factors determine whether genetically susceptible twins will contract lupus. Now, researchers had previously identified at least 17 different genes involved in lupus. If those genes alone were responsible for determining whether a person gets lupus, then every time one identical twin got the disease, the other one would too. But that doesn't happen. Between 40% and 75% of the time, when one twin develops lupus, the other stays healthy. And that suggests that it's some environmental factor that must trigger the disease. Now, the researchers examined methylation of 807 genes, which sounds like a huge number, but it's really not. That is a very small number of genes in the human genome, of over 20,000 total. Dr. Ballestar plans to expand his search. He expects to find many other genes also have reduced levels of methylation in people with lupus. It's not clear whether twins start out with different levels of DNA methylation, or if something in the environment, like a viral infection, triggers those changes later. One thing that the researchers did note is that the methylation patterns alone do not cause lupus. You have to have mutated genes there somewhere to begin with. Then it's just a question of whether the environment allows them to be turned on or not. Ballestar says, quote, "An underlying genetic susceptibility must be necessary to develop the disease," unquote. Right now, there is no way that we can change methylation patterns in living cells. But if we could, then Ballestar's work suggests many future medical treatment possibilities. Ballestar says, quote, "Although it's really speculative in the context of autoimmune diseases, one thing about methylation changes is that they are potentially reversible," unquote. Okay, on to the final story of the night. Last month, you may remember that I had a rather strange story concerning cannabis. Well, it only seems fair to give equal time to another chemical vice this month. Yes, I'm talking about everyone's perennial and legal favorite, alcohol. In this case, the story concerns hard liquor. So for years, the urban legend has been passed from college student to college student that clear liquors, like gin and vodka, will give you less of a hangover the next day than dark liquors like bourbon or scotch whiskey. Well, someone finally decided to look into the truth of that old sophomore's tale. Dr. Damaris Rushnow of Brown University, in the January issue of the journal Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research, found that in a head-to-head comparison, that bourbon gave drinkers a more severe hangover than vodka. The researchers recruited 95 healthy adults, aged 21 to 33, and gave them caffeine-free cola mixed with bourbon, vodka, or tonic water. Now, this experiment was performed blindly. In other words, no participant knew what they were drinking and so could not be biased later. The drinking ended when participants' breath alcohol concentrations hit an average of 0.11, which is over the legal blood alcohol limit in the U.S. The drunk volunteers were then hooked up to sleep monitors and allowed to sleep it off. At 7 a.m. the next day, the researchers roused the subjects from bed and asked them to rate the severity of their hangovers. I have a feeling they were not quite so happy to have volunteered that morning than they were the night before, especially since the researchers did not allow them coffee, aspirin, or liquids of any kind until they spilled their guts. Metaphorically, of course. Overall, the bourbon drinkers reported feeling worse than the vodka drinkers, rating higher on scales that measured the severity of hangover malaise, including headache, nausea, loss of appetite, and thirst. Of course, the control group that only drank the tonic water felt much better than anyone who drank alcohol. But I imagine that it should have been fairly clear the evening before who got the tonic water and who got the alcohol-laced drinks. Dr. Rushnow says, quote, "One reason for the different effects of vodka and bourbon is that bourbon contains 37 times more toxic compounds than vodka does, including nasty organic molecules such as acetone, acetaldehyde, tannins, and furfural." She also says that a good rule of thumb for liquors is that the clearer they are, the less of those nasty substances they contain. Now, any drinker of scotch, especially wonderful single malts, will tell you that they drink scotch specifically for all those wonderful toxic chemicals that give dark liquor its taste and flavor and character. A serious scotch drinker will look down his nose at you if you hand him a glass of gin. In the study, both the bourbon drinkers and the vodka drinkers slept poorly compared to non-drinkers. Not exactly unexpected. The next morning, when the participants performed cognitive tests that required attention and quick reaction times, the drinkers performed worse than the non-drinkers. But the type of alcohol had no effect whatsoever on performance. Both groups of drinkers were impaired equally. So we can conclude that you may suffer less the next morning from drinking a clear liquor, but your nervous system will be just as seriously messed up. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, stay away from that bottle of Canadian Club, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella. And hey, notice? There were no ant stories this month. Ha! And you guys thought I was a one-trick pony. Good night, everyone.